the previous installment, we were in the middle of the conversation where Reb Wolf de Shamash was explaining to one of his friends about the Tzaddikim Nestorim, the hidden Tzaddikim, the hidden righteous mystics who would wander from place to place in order to inspire the Anoshim Pshutim, the simple folk. And this was related by the Moshe Leib to the Baruch, having been a young student and hearing this conversation as they were sitting and learning. The Wolf continued that it was in about the year 5381 or 5383 that this society of Tzaddikim Nestorim, of hidden Tzaddikim, was established by Rabbi Yoh Baal Shem, and ever since, thousands upon thousands of ordinary Jews have been brought back to the service of Hashem. And don't imagine, my friend, the Shamash concluded, that these Tzaddikim did not pay the highest respect to scholars. On the contrary, in their association with uneducated people, they stressed again and again and always strove to make them realize the importance of the Torah and the necessity of their showing respect to everything and everyone connected with the Torah. How can you therefore say that they were not carrying out the teachings of our sages? As Torah scholars themselves, they were entitled themselves to be respected. Yet, they readily dispensed with this claim, working as they were, as simple people, disguised as simple people, for a higher and more unselfish purpose. Shaya Leib still seemed to be unconvinced. Granting that the first mystics were great tzaddikim, whose sole aim was to serve their fellow Jews, he said, doesn't it follow that in their constant association with the ordinary folk, they would as a result lose their esteem and respect? The Shamas was not in the least dismayed, but pointed out that people like Yeshaya Leib were so concerned with the question of respect and honor of scholars that they forget the greater importance of respect towards the Almighty. How could Yeshaya Leib condemn these mystics who were engaged in such holy work, not caring in the smallest degree that they had no physical comfort, no home life, and not even recognition of the sacrifices that they were making? Their whole purpose in life was to succeed in elevating the ordinary Jew to a higher spiritual level, to bring him nearer to Hashem, and to implant in his heart a feeling of love for the Torah and a desire to carry out its mitzvahs. And yet, it was these noble and selfless people who Yeshaya Leib tried to belittle. Moshe Leib and Gedolim Eli, the two young men who were studying the Beis HaMedrash, Gedolim Eli being the son of Reb Wolf, and Moshe Leib was his study companion, they sat open-mouthed, swallowing every word that reached their ears. Gedolim Eli was 2 years older than his friend, and had already heard a good deal about the Mekubolim, about the mystics, from his father, the Shamash. But to Moshe Leib, this was all new, and he was very eager to learn more about these wonderful mystics. He urged his friend to tell him all the stories he knew about these remarkable people, and as he listened, enraptured, they completely captivated him and fired his imagination. "Be a sport and do me a favor," Moshe Leib pleaded with Gedolim Eli. "You tell me that your father knows and meets so many mystics when they come to this town. Please introduce me to one of them, or at least tell me where I can see one." Gedolim Eli nodded his head in what Moshe Leib took to mean a sign of assent. But 2, 3, and 4 months passed, and Moshe Leib had still not seen a mystic. He took this to mean that none had come to Bashenkovich during this time. For while his friend continued to tell him all sorts of wonderful and exciting stories about the mystics, he never mentioned that any of them had lately been in town. After some consideration of the matter, however, it occurred to Moshe Leib that his friend was possibly deliberately withholding such information from him, perhaps on the request of his father Wolf, who must have had some reason for keeping information regarding his mystical friends a secret. One day, as Moshe Leib was making his way thoughtfully to the Beis HaMedrash, he noticed a group of people all gathered around a tall man, listening to what he was telling them as they stood in the street. Michelet was rather interested to know what this was all about, and so he edged his way into the crowd until he stood right in the center, and with a good view of the mysterious stranger who was attracting such an audience in the middle of a weekday. The speaker was most striking in appearance. Although it was a warm, sunny day, he was dressed in a fur-edged coat with a wintry-looking hat. He was tall, dark-haired, and distinguished-looking, with a fine, thin face. His eyes shone with enthusiasm as he spoke earnestly to his audience. The speaker's words called forth as much wonder in Michelet as his unusual appearance. He was explaining the importance of dealing honestly with people in business. He painted a terrible picture of the punishment due to those who tried to take business away from others. Everyone listened intently and respectfully. Michelet decided without hesitation that this must be a mystic, and that thought just thrilled him. For months he had been dreaming and praying to meet a mystic, and before his very eyes was a man who could not be other than a mystic. He could hardly get to the Beis HaMidrash quickly enough to tell Grinamelli his exciting news. They both got excited together, for Grinamelli agreed there was no doubt that the stranger whom Michelet had described was indeed a mystic. Grinamelli was as interested as his friend to have a look at the speaker, and so they both hurried along to see if he was still speaking. Sure enough, there he stood, head and shoulders above the crowd, which had grown considerably in size since Michelet had left. It was now absolutely impossible for them to make their way through the crowd, and they had to content themselves to remain on the edge, where they could not catch very clearly what the speaker was saying. They saw that Grinamelli's father, Wolf, was standing in the middle of the crowd, right near the speaker, and everyone seemed so interested in the words of the mystic that one could have heard a pin drop. The boys were somewhat disappointed that they hadn't managed to obtain a better view, nor hear more clearly what the speaker had been saying, and so they went home. Michelet did not see the mystic again, nor in fact any other mystics. For that evening, on reaching home, when he excitedly told his father about his exciting experience and that this had meant so much to him, he was greatly surprised and very saddened with his father's reception of this news. His father had listened to his narration without interruption, but when he had finished, he said to him that he must promise never again to waste his precious time on such unworthy matters as mystics and mysticism. Michelet could scarcely believe his ears. How was it possible that his father could have such a totally different opinion about mystics than his friends Grinamelli and his learned father? Still, he considered, his own father was certainly no less a scholar than the Shamus, and in any case, it was his duty to respect his father's wishes and obey him. He felt as if he had, without any warning, had a bucket of cold water poured upon him. And on top of everything, his father had demanded that he give up his friendship with Grinamelli. Michelet felt very unhappy and disappointed. To think that his father had such a low opinion of these mystics that he regarded them with contempt and even with hate? While Michelet wanted to ask his father for more reasons for his virulent opposition, he could see that his father was not inclined to discuss the matter further. So he decided it would be wiser to postpone further questioning for a more opportune moment. Michelet had no further opportunity of going into the matter again, for his father Yosef Akida had packed him off to Vitebsk to study at the yeshiva there. The main reason for his step being probably that he wished to keep him from Grinamelli. Before leaving home, he had made his son promise that he would devote all his time purely to the study of Torah and nothing else. Michelet kept his promise and made no efforts during the 7 years that he was at the Vitebsk yeshiva to interest himself in mystics. But despite this, he could not fail even there to hear now and again of some activities on the part of the mystics. Evidently, these activities were too positive to remain unnoticed or unadvertised. He could not understand, however, why it was that whenever these mystics were mentioned here in the Vitebsky Yeshiva, only bad things were reported of them and never good. He would have been so anxious to investigate this matter, which puzzled and troubled him. But remembering his promise to his father, he did not pursue the matter. When Moshe Leib returned home after a 7-year stay at the Yeshiva Vitebsk, his father's first question was to inquire if he had kept his promise about mystics. Moshe Leib assured him that he had kept his word, and this pleased his father very much. Nevertheless, Yosef Akiva wished him to know that in the course of these years he had satisfied himself that there were indeed some great tzaddikim and goinim among these mystics. Moshe Leib was astonished at his father's admission, but he still maintained that his son had better leave this matter of Kabbalah alone, for it required much time and preparation devoted to it, which he could ill spare. At the same time, to be fair, he asked him never to speak ill of these mystics. Moshe Leib felt inclined to inquire further of his father the reason which had prompted him to change his previous definitely hostile opinion of the mystics, but he already recognized by the look at it on his father's face that he preferred to consider the subject closed. Moshe Leib decided that he would bring up the question again at some future date, but the opportunity never returned, and during that year his father unfortunately passed away, so Moshe Leib was never to know the answer of that riddle. As for Moshe Leib's Rebbe, his teacher at the yeshiva, there was no question as to his bitter resentment of these mystics and their line of thought. He openly declared he would fight them at every turn. Moshe Leib quoted his teacher as being particularly indignant and furious at the fact that a certain Melamed, who later became a shochet, a teacher of young children, who later became a ritual slaughterer, should have had the effrontery to represent himself as being a miracle worker and call himself the master of the good name. This, of course, referred to the Baal Shem Tov, Rabbi Yisrael Baal Shem Tov, and it was the mystics who were his followers and supporters who narrated wonderful stories about him. These stories simply infuriated Moshe Leib's teacher. Now everything was becoming clear to Baruch. He realized that on the one hand, he was confronting the followers of Rabbi Yisrael Baal Shem Tov, while on the other hand, he was face to face with his opponents, the Misnagdim. Right here in the Smith's house in the Bromsel, he had representatives of both parties in the persons of the Smith's sons-in-law. They were symbolic of the two divided camps among the Jews, the youngest son-in-law representing the Hasidic camp, and the two older sons-in-law representing the Misnagdic camp. The opposition which Moshe Leib felt towards Hasidim was mainly due to the things he had learned from his teacher in the yeshiva. Whenever the latter mentioned the name of the Baal Shem Tov, he would express himself in bitter terms, saying that he and his followers were a positive danger to their fellow Jews, and that it was wisest to keep them at a distance. But Moshe Leib, remembering his father's injunction to utter no word in connection with Hasidim or Hasidism, kept silent. In any event, Hasidism was for him up to now a closed book. Baruch now felt he must get right deep down into the matter and see what Hasidism really represented. He was particularly anxious to get to know all he could about the founder of the group of the mystics, Rabbi Eliyahu Baal Shem Tov of Worms. Baruch's discoveries were rather startling. The Goyinim, Rabbi Avrom Zev of Ashenkevich, Rabbi Simcha Zelig of Vitebsk, were the bitterest opponents of Hasidim. This opposition had been handed down to them traditionally. They accepted it from Rav Nochem the Porosh of Zolkov, who in turn had received it from Rav Shammai Zundel of Prague, who was a son of the Tzaddik Rav Simcha Zelig of Shpave. They all had one thing in common. They believed it was a mitzvah to persecute the mystics. Rav Simcha Zelig was the absolute antithesis of Rabbi Eliyahu Baal Shem Tov. Now let's see who was this rebel Yoval Shem Tov. Baruch was positively thrilled when he became acquainted with the facts. It was about the year 5261, about 1501, or about 1505, when a certain Spanish Jew named Yosef Yospa arrived in Krakow. And not only was he a great scholar, but also a veritable saint. At that time he was already 50 years of age, and everyone soon knew that the Spanish Jew was something of a hermit, that he was a confirmed bachelor, and that he was so fearful of doing anything wrong that he kept himself completely apart from others. Thus passed 30 years. The Jews of Krakow had the greatest respect for this tzaddik and felt he would probably continue to live as he did to the end of his days. Then something happened to stir them all out of their settled convictions. At that time there lived in Krakow a well-known rich merchant by the name of Levi, who had many business dealings with the nobility. This Levi was a great philanthropist whose house was open to all. Levi had a son whose name was Yosef, whom he married to the daughter of Avram, who was a goldsmith and a God-fearing Jew. After his marriage, Yosef helped his father in his business and soon became the brains of the firm. He was not only that, but he was in general a brilliant young man. He knew several languages, and his vast knowledge included a wide appreciation and understanding of worldly matters. Obviously, such a man could be of great use to the nobility with whom he did business, and they certainly recognized his outstanding qualities. They loved to indulge in discussions with him on politics or whatever was uppermost in the public mind at the moment. There never was any language barrier as far as he was concerned, and so everyone found it a pleasure to have conversation with him. His fellow Jews also realized how useful he could prove himself to be. Frequently, they availed himself of his good offices by reason of his friendship with the nobility. He was always asked to be the mediator between themselves and the authorities, which he always accepted readily, only too happy to be of service to them. Meanwhile, the business carried on by himself and his father flourished exceedingly, and it was often necessary for Yosef to take long trips, especially to Prague. And unfortunately, it was on such a trip that he and his assistant were attacked by robbers and killed. When the shocking news of this tragedy reached Krakow, the whole community went into mourning. Yosef had left a widow who was childless, and so she had to carry out the din and obtain chalitza from her late husband's brother. In those days, it was an old custom in Krakow for chalitza to be carried out with great ceremony, after which the members of the Besen rose and blessed the woman that she might soon remarry and bear children. The shamash then came forward and called out that if there were a man present who wished to marry the woman who had just obtained chalitza, would he please step forward and be blessed. No one responded on this particular occasion, but about 5 months later, Yosef Yospa, or as he was more commonly called in Krakow, the Spanish Jew, suddenly came to the Besen and announced that he wished to marry the widow if it were also agreeable to her. He explained that it had never been his intention ever to marry, but now, for reasons which he did not wish to divulge, he had decided to get married despite his advancing years. Saying this, he left. The Besen then sent word to the widow, asking her to appear at the Besen. On arrival, even before she had managed to ask the reason for being called, she suddenly burst into tears. "Why are you crying?" she was asked. "I have a terrible secret weighing me down, yet I cannot make up my mind whether to tell you about it or not," she replied in a choked voice. She was further pressed to tell them a little more about this matter, which was troubling her so much. But all she would say was that it was in connection with a dream she had, which kept on recurring, and in which her father, who had been dead many years, appeared before her. He repeatedly urged her to do something, but she could not make up her mind whether she ought to obey him or not. She also found it difficult to reveal to the Besen the nature of this particular request on the part of her long-departed father. The fact that she had the same dream on several occasions worried her so that she could find no peace, and would be grateful if they would advise her what she should do. After they had consulted among themselves, Abesna decided that it would be best for her to tell them her secret. The poor woman then tearfully told them that her father had appeared in their first dream, dressed in his Shabbos clothes, and stretched out his hands over her head, blessed her, saying, "And now I wish you Mazel Tov, for it has been decreed that you marry the Spanish saint Yosef Yospa." The Chalitza, as the woman was known, told the Besen that when she awoke from this first dream, she was trembling violently, but attached no special significance to the dream, thinking that she had just had an ordinary dream. But less than a week later, her father again appeared in her dream and repeated that she must marry Yosef Yospa. Even so, she did not take it seriously, but thought of it as just another dream. But shortly afterwards, she again dreamed that her father appeared, this time looking very serious, and telling her she must ask someone to speak to Yosef Yospa and arrange about their getting married. "There was no way out of it," he said, "for it had been decided in the heavenly court. If you will do my bidding," said the father, "you will be blessed with a son, but if you disobey me, you will come to a bad end." After the dream had occurred three times, she felt she must go to the Besen about the matter, and she had just so decided when the Shamash had come to tell her that the Besen had sent for her. The members of the Besen looked at each other in astonishment at the strange coincidence, and told the woman that Yosef Yospa had himself called on them to tell them that he wished to marry her if agreeable to her. The woman was now in no doubt that it was the divine will that she should marry the Spanish saint, and so the marriage was arranged without delay. It was the custom in Caracas that whenever a chalutza married, it was a public festivity, and so the whole community came to the wedding. It was another Krakow custom that in such a case all the Koyanim from Bar Mitzvah age and upwards, dressed in their talesim and kitlin, lined up on both sides of the aisle and blessed the bride and groom as they walked to the canopy. The reception, the Sudas Chasen, the reception repast, was also conducted along the lines of an old custom, which was that it was held outside the shul, in the open, where all the guests ate the food which they themselves had brought along. Everyone in Krakow felt that this was no ordinary match, but that there was an inner significance beyond their comprehension. Before his marriage, Rabbi Yosef Yospa had lived without any regard to his physical comforts, sleeping on a hard bench in the Beis HaMedrash and contenting himself with a dry crust of bread and a drink of water for a meal. But now that he was married, things were different. The Krakow Jewish community, who felt themselves responsible for the couple's welfare, realized that a room must be found for them. They must be provided with their household necessities. In the second year of his marriage, Yosef Yospa became the father of a son, whom he named Eliyahu, after the prophet. The child was barely 2 years old when his father already began to teach him Torah. He taught him himself, not wishing to entrust his education to any other teacher. At the age of 7, the boy already accompanied his father to his midnight attendances at the Beis HaMedrash. He told his little son that he must not indulge in any talk which was not holy, neither must he discuss Torah matters with anyone. Yosef Yospa used to take his son into his private study, and there in solitude, he instructed him in the Torah. About 2 weeks before Eliyahu's bar mitzvah, Yosef Yospa called his wife to him and told her that he felt his end was approaching, but asked that there be no mourning for his passing. "You are still comparatively young, my wife," the old man said to her, "and it's very likely that you will have an opportunity to remarry. But my wish is that you do not marry again. And as for our dear son, I know that soon after his bar mitzvah he will tell you of his desire to leave home and go forth into the world. Do not dissuade or discourage him from his decision, for you should know that he has been sent down on earth to serve a special purpose, his mission being to go among the people and uplift them and help them. He is the first of a long chain of generations who will play a great and important role in history right up to the time of the coming of Mashiach. Eliyahu Hanavi himself has been teaching our Eliyahu so that he is fully prepared and trained for this great mission for which he has come down to live on this earth." Rabbi Yosef Yospa also told his wife that when her first husband was killed, he received a divine command to marry this widow, for a son would be born to them, would be of exceptionally high status, spiritually and morally, and that he would have a special mission to fulfill. Rabbi Yosef Yospa then called for the heads of the Krakow community, and with his dying breath thanked them for all they had done for him, his wife, and son, and asked them to care for his widow and orphan child after his death. He gave them all his blessing, and then closed his eyes. and passed away. Leo said Kaddish and learned for the soul of his father. For the first time, the Krakow Jewish people saw what a genius they had in their midst in the person of this young lad. They were amazed at his obvious scholarship and listened open-mouthed as he learned Torah in the Beis HaMedrash. They all could see, too, how saintly was this most unusual boy, and they all flocked with great interest to attend his bar mitzvah. A few weeks later, Leo came to his mother and told her that he wished to go forth and wander about, mentioning no specific places. His mother, having been prepared by her late husband, said not a word in opposition to this decision of her young son, though it was obvious that she must have accepted it with mixed feelings. And so she gave her son her blessing, and he left. Nothing was heard of Leo, even by his mother, for about 40 years. For he had left home in the year 5310, and it was not until the year 5350 that he suddenly appeared in the city of Worms in Germany. He was then known already as Rabbi Leo Baal Shem. When he came to Worms, he brought his wife with him. His children were all married, a son and two daughters, who all lived a long way off, it was said. Rabbi Leo Baal Shem very quickly became famous as a healer and miracle worker, and people flocked to him from near and far. It was said that people who came to him who were very sick came away healed after his treatments. In many cases, he did not even use medicine, but would talk to the patients, finding out what was troubling them, and would often heal them by appealing to them to improve their mode of living by raising it to a higher spiritual level. This method of healing proved very successful, and whatever his cures, his name spread far and wide, and his house was an ever-open door to all who needed him. Rabbi Leo Baal Shem also established a yeshiva and was himself responsible for its support. The majority of Rabbi Leo's patients were poor people. They came to him from everywhere. They stayed at his home for weeks and even months. The Baal Shem lived thus in Worms for 10 years, his fame increasing with every year that passed. His wonders were talked about for hundreds of miles around. In the next installment, Emir Tzashem, we continue with Rabbi Leo Baal Shem Tov and how that led up to the Baal Shem, Rabbi Yisrael Baal Shem Tov.